Welcome to Evolutions Per Minute. I'm your host, Dan Seif, and this is the podcast that explores the connection between hip-hop and jazz. These two art forms, created by Black American artists, share a lot of the same DNA, but the stories of how they're connected haven't really been told. So many hip-hop songs sample jazz records, and in most cases, the jazz and hip-hop artists have never even met. Each episode of Evolutions Per Minute, I will bring together these jazz and hip-hop artists for the very first time to talk about these two styles and learn about how these genres are related. This is Evolutions Per Minute. On this episode of Evolutions Per Minute, I'm going to be speaking with the incredible musician Patrice Rushen, whose music has been sampled almost 500 times.
And sometimes the use of people's music was actually very creative, where they would use a sample, you know, 4 bars, 8 bars, and then use it as a musical basis to do something different with it. Mm-hmm. You know, they would maybe turn it upside down.
Yeah.
Or they would take a particular phrase and put another phrase with it, therefore creating something new.
Patrice Rushen is an incredible jazz and fusion piano and keyboard player, composer, arranger, and vocalist who's been successful across so many parts of the music business. She's had R&B hits that she wrote and sang, played piano with dozens of jazz legends, and composed music for major events like the Grammys. Her songs have also been sampled for hip-hop songs more than 400 times. The most famous example is one that everyone would know from the movie Men in Black. That song was the theme to the movie Men in Black, and it samples Patrice Rushen's song Forget Me Nots. I was able to talk to Patrice Rushen about her history in music and get her thoughts on hip-hop from the perspective of someone whose music is all over hip-hop but has never played on any hip-hop records herself. What was your introduction to jazz, first of all?
Well, my introduction to it was just that it was part of the music that my parents played around the house with records. They didn't play instruments themselves, you know, weren't musicians or anything, but they were really, really, really music lovers. And they belonged to a record club. And it was called a Columbia Record Club. And they would send you a record every month. And it would be of all styles, not just jazz, classical music, pop music of that day, all this music. And when we would be cleaning up the house on Saturdays, the routine was, you know, you had your record player and the record player had a spindle that would hold all of the vinyl. You could put maybe about 6 of them down. And they would all drop down one at a time and play. And so there was music in our house all day. And there was a lot of jazz, because my parents were also very conscious of the contribution, even then, of the Black experience and how it impacted the dance music, how it impacted, you know, the society and all of this. So I heard a lot of different stuff. I didn't recognize it as being jazz per se, but I knew that that's what they called it. And I either liked what I was hearing or I didn't like what I was hearing. But it was a part of a routine that we just had. It was music in the house all the time. There was a lot of jazz. So that's my introduction. Then later, that vocabulary and that harmony, the idea of what was happening, somebody explained to me, you know, maybe as a teenager, what was going on with this jazz thing. And it's like, well, see, they have this melody and this structure, and then they improvise. They make up stuff that goes within the structure. And so I'm saying, wait a minute. As they're playing, they're making up stuff within this structure. Well, that was fascinating to me, because I had grown up learning the piano vis-a-vis classical music. And the last thing that you were doing was making up stuff. Even though on my own, I was picking out stuff off the radio and trying to write a little bit. You know, it wasn't as organized then in my head as I can say it to you now. Uh-huh. But the idea was that I was always intrigued with the idea of composition, and with jazz being almost like spontaneous composition, uh-huh, or having that element in it. It was very attractive to me. And by the time I got to high school, when there was a consciousness about the contributions of Black Americans and contributions of this music to the world, uh-huh, and that it, that was one of many ways in which the information allowed us to accept the responsibility of excellence if we were going to call ourselves wanting to go into that field. Uh-huh. And so we were learning American classical music, which was jazz. Uh-huh. So that by the time I got to high school, I was all in. Uh-huh. I was still trying to figure it out, but I was all in terms of the commitment to that idea that all of what I would ever listen to from that point on or play from that point on was somehow influenced by this thing called jazz. Uh-huh. And that became the new basis for the communication of music for me.
Do you remember like early on a particular record that was like, wow, this is something I gotta, you know, delve into?
Oh, yeah. My parents really loved Ella Fitzgerald, the sound of her voice. I can't remember if there's a particular song or anything, but the sound of her voice was attractive to me. And because she straddled this line between precision and freedom. I thought the feeling was awesome. And then later, you know, I got into Sarah Vaughan and all these other people and realized that a lot of the playing that I was hearing, whether it was horns or keyboards or whatever, was attempting to mimic some of that same freedom in terms of the lyricism of the playing. So if there was a particular record where it came together for me, where I was like, oh, wait a minute, just, you know, one day it just hit you. It was Watermelon Man.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
I've never told Herbie that or anybody, or I'm probably the first one I'm telling now.
The first one, the original Watermelon?
That one, the original Watermelon.
Oh, wow.
It's Watermelon Man. Yeah. Because by this time, I had enough awareness, or at least enough of an aural vocabulary and then information to be able to understand what was going on. You know, it was not as complex as other things, but the same ideas were happening, and now I could start to put it together, and then that's where the solo starts, and that's being made up right now, and so it was that kind of thing happening, and then it allowed me to be able to go deeper into a lot of other areas.
Wow.
And stuff like that. But that was how things kind of came together. And it was just that moment where,
all starts to make sense.
All came together. Yeah.
Okay. So now getting more into the subject matter of this show, what were your impressions when you started to hear rap and hip hop? And especially when you started to hear that it was using elements of other people's records. What were your thoughts about that initially?
Well, you know, at first, what concerned me wasn't really hip hop, because I could identify with the idea that young people of all generations, I think that there's a way in which music, or the perception of music, allows for them to be able to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the deterioration of bands and orchestras in school. So it wasn't to me a big leap when of the elements of music that are always present in all music, when rhythm and the idea of rhythm became out front. You know, I'd always been into dance music and stuff like that too, because I like to dance. And, you know, I came up listening at the same time I was listening to, you know, hearing Miles and hearing this and that. I was also hearing James Brown and Sly Stone and the Beatles and Rolling Stones and stuff like that. And I like that too. I really did. So anyway, getting back to the point of your question. So it wasn't really a surprise that fewer people were adopting the idea of playing instruments in the way that they had, and utilizing this flow in terms of rap and the messages that were initially happening in terms of the whole hip hop thing. A lot of them were a lot of fun. They were fun, and they were or they were based in some information or something like that. Now, as the content of what was being said started to change, I think I began to wonder, you know, is this a good thing, or, you know, what is going on? Mm. Because now we don't have the balance. It's not fun now.
Mm.
It's like, it's really, you know, some other things going on with this, and some of which did not appear to be based in the idea of this music and these musical elements being used to communicate something beyond a certain imagery that I wasn't necessarily in agreement with.
Mm-hmm.
The use of other people's music is related and yet different. I think the use of other people's music came down to what I was saying initially, where people stopped playing.
Mm.
They weren't learning how to play. And sometimes the use of people's music was actually very creative, where they would use a sample, you know, 4 bars,
mm-hmm.
8 bars, and then use it as a musical basis to do something different with it. Mm-hmm. You know, they would maybe turn it upside down.
Yeah.
Or they would take a particular phrase and put another phrase with it, therefore creating something new.
Mm-hmm.
Almost as if it was another instrument.
Right.
You know, another
right.
sound, another tool, another way in which to take something that exists,
mm-hmm.
and find a way to reframe it in such a way that it creates something
new.
Different.
Yeah.
It's a sum of the parts that creates the third part.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that a lot. When I would hear that kind of thing and recognize it, I was like, oh, that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's dope, mm-hmm. you know. But then the samples started getting longer. And longer and longer and longer and longer and longer. And pretty soon it was just this record put on top of this lyric.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so it began to feel like, okay, there's these factions of this now
right.
that are kind of, there's the super creative trying to do something with these sounds and allow that to spawn additional something or other,
uh-huh.
whether it's additional poetry, additional lyricism, melodically, additional rhythmic content or whatever. And then there's this other side that's just grab it and go.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And grab it and go sometimes was like, is this lazy now?
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, because sometimes even in the message of the grab and go, it's like, well, what?
Mm-hmm.
What are we saying?
Mm-hmm.
Or why are we saying it? Or I'm looking for the art in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not hearing it.
Mm.
And so it just seemed like there were these different factions of it,
yeah.
you know. But I will say this, I have to be honest, you know, that there's a part of me that is honored when some of my music is used in order to create
something new,
a moment
mm-hmm.
for people. But I have turned down those where I didn't agree with the moment that they were creating.
Mm.
I haven't said yes to everything.
Wow.
Because it's like, wow, I spent a lot of energy and time and creative, you know, and production, you know, expertise to put something together that was lasting at least long enough for you to find it
mm.
20 or 30 years later. Mm. And you're going to take it and what you going to do?
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I want to feel like there's at least that kind of respect
mm-hmm.
in what you're going to put out
mm-hmm.
when you decide you're going to use it. And I have to, but in my case, to be really honest, in my case, I would say 80% of the time, it's been awesome.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you about the most well-known one would be Men in Black. So what are your mm-hmm. thoughts, or what could you share about that experience?
Oh, I've got a great story for you for Men in Black.
Okay.
Great story. So Men in Black, for the listeners who I'm sure they all know, but it uses a song called Forget Me Nots,
uh-huh.
which was a big hit for me
uh-huh.
in 1982. First thing you need to know is a little background information that in 1982, when Forget Me Nots was turned in, the record company didn't like it at all.
Wow.
It was like, okay, well, we don't hear anything on this album, so I don't,
uh-huh.
you know. So that was my first inkling that, you know, you can't depend on the record company. You're going to have to do something yourself if you really believe in
uh-huh.
it. They would at that, and back in the day, they would put the records out, you know, and your record, it didn't sell that much. It would buy the paper stamps or the, you know,
yeah.
rubber bands or something. It, you know, they would just put stuff out.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, but we went after it in terms of independent promotion. So there was a big lesson in that for us
uh-huh.
to learn that you have to also stand behind what it is that you're going to do. And sometimes you have to get it in front of the people. And that was our idea,
uh-huh.
get it in front of people to hear it. Anyway, it blows up. It becomes this big hit for me and, you know, all of that. Then about 10 years later, there was this movie called Big. with Tom Hanks, there's a trampoline scene. They almost played a whole record in the trampoline scene. Then a few years later after that, I get this cassette in the mail. And it's from, I guess, what was it, 20th Century Fox or whatever it was. And they said, please come and pick up your one-time payment of $2,000 for the use of a small use of a sample of your song Forget Me Nots in this mega film, Men in Black, starring Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith. And I had been to the movies and seen the trailer. And I said, oh, this is going to be good. But the music wasn't in the trailer yet. So I didn't know. I get this mail and I'm playing the cassette and I said, small sample.
It's a whole.
It's the exact track. You know, they've sped it up or slowed it down or whatever they did. I can't remember now. And a new vocal and, you know, but the melody is the same. I said, wow. I said, this is cool, but something's not right. Because I didn't, you know, $2,000 sounds a little light to me.
Yes.
So I sent it to my attorney and we didn't have FedEx back then. So that was the longest 2 days for it to get across town. And then, you know, him to say, okay, this is not a sample. This is a copyright situation here. This is them taking your composition, putting something else on top of that composition to make a new composition. You should be sharing in the writers and the publishing of this new composition. I said, okay. So he says, so I'm going to call them and I'm going to talk to them about this. Because this is clearly what they had sent was not a demo. This was it. So, of course, they said, oh, of course not. We're not going to do that. Because what we asked for was half. And they said, oh, no, we're not going to do that. So my lawyer said, well, then you need to take her half out, which is all the music,
right.
The melody, everything. And of course, that wasn't going to happen. And we were able to work it out and everything. But the reason I share that with you is because now people typically they will ask first. But back then, sampling was new. It was like the Wild West. People were just doing all kind of stuff and they just didn't know. The idea of being able to ask and follow it up and have a place. I was lucky because I had already been in the music industry at least enough to have a lawyer, to have a situation where it felt like this wasn't enough money. You know, there's a lot of people they don't know and they get taken on that one time ask. And then the idea of not being willing to walk away when it's not fair. When it's not fair, you have to be willing to walk away. You know, they could have said no. I don't know why they would have, but they could have said no. And then, you know, but I would have been no worse off. So I learned a lot of lessons through the process of just watching that happen, not the least of which that, you know, 25 years prior to that, practically, or however long it was, you know, people that said, this, no way, song, no way. You know?
I have a question about that. After it was a hit, what did the people who had said no way, was there any follow-up there? I'm just curious to know.
Oh, yeah, they gave me, it was the record company, and they gave me my money back that I put into independent promotion.
Oh, wow, okay.
They gave it back.
That's great.
They said, here you go, we were wrong.
Wow.
I'm like, yeah.
Wow.
You know, and back then, I was trying to learn to be a little bit more evolved than to be like, yeah, that's right. You know, inside I'm like, yeah, that's right.
Wow. So what I like to do is play some of the songs that you have recorded that have been sampled for hip hop and just get your reaction. See what you think about that.
Okay. That's cool.
All right. So let's start with Temperatures Rising by Mobb Deep, which samples Where There Is Love. So first, a little bit of Where There Is Love. And now, Mobb Deep, Temperatures Rising. Like six deep, asking all your whereabouts and where you sleep. They said they just want to question you. For me and you know, then once they catch you, all they do is just arrest you, then arraign you, hang you. I don't think so. It's a good thing you bounce for now. Thoughts?
Thoughts. Well, you know, they chose a good part.
Yeah.
And it works really well, you know, for what I don't know how they find, you know, I would kind of like to know how they determine what's cool, you know, what they're going to use. I don't know that. So I'm always, that for me is the kind of amazing part. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow.
I like the way that one works though, because it starts with just the beat. So it's very spare. Then there's that other part. And then your part comes in third. So it's sort of a, almost like an arranging thing where you would add.
Exactly. I was going to comment on that, how on this particular example.
Yeah.
That's what I hear. Yeah. I hear the thought of placement, which is no different than some of the thought of placement in terms of what the composition, when you write the composition. Mm-hmm. See, that's the time. Those are the kind of intersections and hookups for me, as you can tell, that I get kind of excited about.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I know that the intention, at least from the standpoint of the music, mm-hmm. that the intention is based in something that is heartfelt to start with.
Mm-hmm.
That whatever that moment of that resonation of truth of like, I want to use those four bars, mm-hmm. is still carrying over into how I'm going to use mm-hmm. those four bars and where I'm going to use those four bars. And you see, for me, that's part of music making, regardless of the genre of music.
Yeah. Taking a piece that you like and reusing it in some way. Yeah. And that, and the way they put that together, your part is a payoff because there's a build up to it. Sparse, mm-hmm. a little less sparse, and then this richer thing comes in. Okay, so this is Hieroglyphics. This is a Bay Area group, and this one uses Didn't You Know, and it starts right out with it. But I'll play a little bit of Didn't You Know first. And this is You Never Knew by the Hieroglyphics. So you're the chorus.
I'm hopefully made the cut.
Mm-hmm. You're the chorus.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Again, you know, knowing a little bit more about what you had said about, you know, what was shared about the process. Again, mm-hmm. you know, again, how do you figure out that that's what you're going to use to say what you're going to say?
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Now, this is one of those where for me, it's hard for me to say, okay, so did you create something and then use something that had already been created and fit it in and superimpose, mm-hmm. or is every part of this somebody else's stuff put together and then you rap on top of it? I've always wondered, you know, I know there are probably several processes for that they use, but sometimes the effect of it being other people's stuff just kind of back to back or superimposed on top of each other, just sonically, is the messaging can become confusing sometimes. Well, what am I supposed to be listening to?
Yeah.
How do I follow where you're going?
Yeah.
That's what was different about the example you played prior to this, mm-hmm. because as you noted, there are ways and layers and then boom. Mm-hmm. Whereas on this one, I'm confused as to, so what should I be listening out for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? Yeah. It's a little bit, this one's a little bit more of a collage, but the other parts that they're using are actually parts of their own record. So they layered your part together with an older record of theirs and then did what they did on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, so those are the only two I thought would be good ones as examples.
Those are interesting, and I think great examples primarily of process.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the other part. See, I use I think sometimes hip-hop and rap gets a bad rap.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because there is a similar assumption that used to belong to music that was commercial versus music that was not.
Mm.
The assumption is that because it's commercial and a lot of people can relate to it and like it, that it is somehow not as deep, not as good, doesn't require nuance, doesn't have specific things that make it what it is. Mm-hmm. And that there's not as much energy or thought that goes into the manipulation of one's emotions to create, you know, a communicative moment or message, mm-hmm. or idea, or get you off your feet, or whatever the music is designed to do.
Mm.
That rap used to go to commercial music, from classical music. You know, you can go classical music, jazz, you know, R&B, pop, blah, blah. Yeah. You know, you follow the line. And hip hop, I think, received a similar, hip hop and rap music received a similar kind of idea. Idea sometimes about how it was just easy to do.
Underestimated.
And, totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Well, any other closing thoughts?
First of all, I love the idea of what it is that this podcast can do. Hopefully, it allows for people to kind of meet the different sides of the musical landscape, wherever they are, to be able to, like, you know, just turn to the left or to the right and notice that you're surrounded by other things, and to not be afraid to take a look and take a listen. Nobody's holding a gun to your head saying you must like this, or you have to understand it, or you have to agree with it, or you're forced to, you know, have a point of view that you've got to have an opinion about it. Allow it. It's art. Allow it to resonate or not. And offer an environment to support, especially when it resonates with you in a positive way, to then go out of your way to support it and let somebody else know. That's how it perpetrates a certain kind of excellence and the idea that there's something to this. That's what music is supposed to do. That's what art is supposed to do. You're supposed to feel something.
The words of the great Patrice Rushen, incredible jazz, R&B artist, composer, arranger, vocalist, and her thoughts on how her music has been used in hip hop. To keep up with Patrice Rushen, you can follow her on her website, patricerushen.com, or on Instagram at patrice.rushen. You've been listening to Evolutions Per Minute. I'm your host, Dan Seif. Tune in for more episodes of this podcast, and don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Evolutions Per Minute is produced by Stephen Ray, Christian Brune, DJ Khalil, and Autovita Studios, and edited by Sean Hettinger. If you like this podcast, you can hear me every week on my radio show, Excursions Radio, on KJazz 88.1 FM in Los Angeles, where I play hip-hop and jazz. You can also stream the show anywhere in the world at kkjz.org. You can follow this podcast on Instagram at Evolutions Per Minute, and you can follow me on Instagram at Chief Seif.
Produced by Autovita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.